time now is 7 o'clock. You're listening to 91.7 KALW San Francisco Local Public Radio and online at KALW.org. Keep it right here for your legal rights.
You're listening to Your Legal Rights on KALW 91.7 FM in San Francisco. I'm Jeff Hayden. Tonight on Your Legal Rights, we're in for a different kind of experience in that we're not necessarily talking about new laws. We're more talking about the difficult choices and high-risk ethical dilemmas, anguish, and euphoria of everyday life for attorneys who represent victims of negligence. My guests tonight are both such attorneys and are standing by to take your calls about tort law, negligence, malpractice, whether it's medical or legal or products liability law. If you have questions for my guests, our phone number to us in the studio is 415-841-4134. Again, that's 415-841-4134. If you're outside of the local dialing area, it's 866-798-8255. That's 866-798-8255. Occasionally, I may neglect to mention that while we're happy to answer all of your questions, we stop short of giving precise legal advice without all the facts relating to a given case. But we're more than happy to pass along the legal principles that can guide your decision-making. And as always, you can call regarding any question on the topic of tort law, negligence, general malpractice, medical malpractice, legal malpractice, products liability law, any of these things that you're interested in. You don't have to be in the exact point we may be in our conversation. And again, our number is 866-798-8255. With me in the studio tonight, my guests, James Bostwick and Eric Peterson, both practicing out of Mill Valley, represent plaintiffs in catastrophic injury cases, in particular in the genres of negligence, personal injury, and medical malpractice in this state and beyond. But in particular, Jim's written a mesmerizing tale that realistically depicts the difficult choices and risks and dilemmas of everyday life for attorneys who represent victims of negligence. And again, if you have questions for Jim about his book, if you have questions for Jim and Eric about their practice, in the studio, 841-4134. If you're outside of San Francisco, toll free, 866-798-8255. And with that, Jim, Eric, let me welcome each of you to Your Legal Rights.
Thank you.
You know, as I mentioned a moment ago, we often talk about nuts and bolts, and we'll get to that. We'll take your calls on various areas of law that we're talking about tonight, but I really wanted to put ourselves a bit in the storyline of those that take such cases and those that bring such cases to those lawyers. And I mentioned that earlier that Jim wrote a book about it, his book, which I'm now holding, called Acts of Omission, was recently nominated for the 2020 Harper Lee Legal Fiction Award. And of course, that award was named for Harper Lee, the author of perhaps the best-known piece of legal fiction in our lifetimes, the 1961 Pulitzer Prize-winning novel, To Kill a Mockingbird. Congratulations on what's clearly a most prestigious award.
Well, thank you. I was nominated for it. Doesn't mean I've won it yet.
Congratulations on the first step towards inevitably receiving a very prestigious award. But seriously, what is the basic story within the book? What is it actually that people really look forward to if they pick that up and to begin to read it?
Well, it's inspired by true events that occurred back in the 80s when I tried a case here in San Francisco. But it's essentially a story about a young lawyer that had a difficult loss and was having a pretty tough time for lots of reasons, and then he's offered a case involving a badly injured young man, a paralyzed young man. But everybody in town tells him he shouldn't take it. It's going to be too expensive for him. It's too difficult. And the worst of it is that he's going to be required to sue probably the most famous lawyer in San Francisco, and certainly the darling of the local media, and probably most people consider the most famous lawyer in the country, they advise him he shouldn't do it, but he gets so involved with his family, he just can't help going further and further until he finds himself with the tar baby. He's enmeshed, and it's sort of what happens after that.
And when we read the basic story in the book, how much truth is there mixed into this story?
Well, there's a lot of things that are true that really happened in that trial. There are a lot of things that really happened in that case in general. There's a lot of things that, of course, didn't happen at all. It's a work of fiction, and it's a novel, and it's got lots of things in it that are fun and interesting. But much of it, probably the most important thing for the person thinking about reading it, is that in terms of what happens in a lawsuit, what a lawyer thinks, has to think about, what a lawyer is going through, the kind of risks, the difficulties, that all is very, very real. What a client is thinking, what a client has to worry about, the choices you have to make, and then the process, the actual trial, which takes over good half of the book, that is very, very much, it's very authentic. It's the real deal.
Now, this isn't a Paul Newman movie in the book, highly fictionalized and really overly dramatized. This is actually true stuff.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, it's real. The real stuff in terms of what can happen and the kind of things that this young man faces in his life, that is the plaintiff, and what the lawyer faces and the difficulties that you have in bringing a lawsuit like this, and what happens in court and the defense lawyers and things like that. Now, there's lots of other things in the book, of course, that happen and characters that are completely out of my imagination. And some of them are very, very much real people. It's actually kind of fun because a lot of the lawyers that have practiced here for many years have fun reading the book and picking
Wait,
out
me.
People. Yeah, I know who that is. Yeah, I know who that is.
For people that aren't necessarily practicing law in this area, what do people really gain by reading it? Obviously, there's some entertainment value and maybe a little bit of educational value as well. But what do people really have to gain by reading it?
You know, for me, if I might say, it's not only an interesting read and a lot of fun to
Bring the mic in just a little closer to you if you can.
How's that? A little better?
Much better.
You know, what it does, most people have a perception of a legal system that's inaccurate. And what the book does is it really kind of drives home all of the challenges that lawyers like Jim, like myself, face from time to time in terms of putting it all on the line for clients. And so it really gives a broader perspective to the reader in terms of what to, you know, what goes on in the civil system.
Yeah, it's meant to give a very real, authentic picture of that. And what kind of risks and choices that a lawyer and clients face.
Let's talk a little bit about that. Well, first, Eric, Jim, your practice includes both medical malpractice and general negligence. Talk to us a little bit about your life practicing. What is the experience like having that kind of a practice?
Well, a lot of people ask, you know, what makes a good case or what makes a good medical malpractice case? And we spend a lot of time reviewing cases before we take them. And on any given day, we may get a half dozen or 10 inquiries about whether or not, you know, do I have a case? And so, you know, what we do as lawyers is, you know, we can look at a case and talk to clients. And if a case appears to be interesting, we order medical records. We get the medical records reviewed by medical experts to confirm with us whether or not we've got a case or something to look into. And then we pursue the case. So most of the people that call in, you know, we don't end up taking their cases, but we explain to them why, you know, and what the system will accommodate. So a lot of the cases we end up taking are cases that involve large economic damages, which means basically – you know, you have someone who's got significant future medical expenses or significant future wage loss. That comprises economic damages, particularly in medical malpractice cases, because I know we want to talk about at some point some of the MICRA limits, or the Medical Insurance Compensation Reform Act limits that were put in place in 1975 to discourage litigation against healthcare providers. One of the key proponents of that MICRA legislation was to cap pain and suffering damages to $250,000. So most of the cases we end up taking have, you know, for instance, a birth-injured child or a brain-injured adult or someone who's deceased with, you know, with their significant wage loss. Those are the cases we end up typically pursuing.
Yeah, actually, maybe out of 25 calls, we might decide to investigate one of them. And out of the ones we investigate, we probably end up pursuing maybe 20%, 25% of those. I mean, if we get one or two cases a month, I would think that would be probably maximum that we actually pursue through the process. And all the way along, as we review it and as we're looking at it and as we're getting information and we're talking to experts, we're still trying to decide, is this a case that we can actually, you know, pursue in a reasonable fashion on behalf of these folks? Because, you know, the worst thing in the world is to have a devastating injury and then to be disappointed by a result that's not what you'd hope for. And so really for the people to go through that process, we really want to make sure that we feel that we'll be likely successful with it, or we don't want to take the case.
And one of the things that's often confusing for people who are looking at cases and asking themselves, do they have a medical malpractice case, is that there are bad outcomes in medicine.
Mm-hmm.
Despite the best efforts, brilliant care, sometimes things don't work as they should. There may be a risk of infection. There may be bleeding. There may be things that occur when everything goes according to plan, but the outcome is not favorable. And so the question oftentimes is this outcome, is this a result of malpractice, or some people say an act of God, or, you know, what is it? So that, by the way, is one of the big defenses in a lot of these cases, that these things could have happened in the best of hands and maybe a risk of the procedure, not necessarily malpractice or what we call a breach of the standard of care. In other words, we have to prove that a healthcare provider did or did not do something that a reasonably prudent physician would do under similar circumstances, and that breach of the standard of care caused the damages or caused the injuries. As opposed to just a, you know, risk of the procedure.
Sometimes bad things happen.
A bad result does not mean it's malpractice. That's right.
And malpractice actually talks about somebody really not dotting the I's, crossing the T's, or really doing the things they have to make sure the best possible outcome is going to occur.
That's yeah. Right.
There are standard approaches to the way you handle certain things, a surgery, to diagnose an illness. And if you go through that process and there is a bad result, that's the way medicine is practiced every day, and not every person has a good result from their medical treatment. What we can do something about is if they fail to follow the standard approaches, if they really use the wrong techniques, or if they should have recognized that the condition they were confronted with had this very dangerous potential cause and they did nothing to check it out, then they have fallen outside of the appropriate standard of medicine. It's very unusual. I mean, most doctors practice a very high quality of medical care. They mean well, and they are trying to do the right thing by their patients. They can't fix everyone.
One thing that's difficult for some people to comprehend first inquiring about a case is where a healthcare provider's clearly committed malpractice or was negligent, but the negligence wasn't the cause of their injuries. And kind of understanding, for instance, in a failure to diagnose cancer case, where if someone doesn't diagnose the cancer, timely, maybe a few months before the diagnosis, it would be difficult to attribute the failure to diagnose the cancer with, say, a bad outcome or staging, because the treatment wouldn't have changed the outcome.
So you would not only have to prove that they should have caught it earlier, but actually that had they done so, maybe they would have had other treatment options, or maybe that, you know, if there were treatment options, they would have worked because of the earlier date and maybe waiting too long.
That's right. The outcome would be different.
And if you can't prove a likelihood that that outcome would be different, then it's probably not a case that you can really do much with.
And that's an interesting point, too, because we talk about the standard of proof. There are lots of possibilities, particularly in a failure to diagnose cancer case or loss of chance, which doesn't apply in California. You have to prove it by a probability or, you know, 50% or greater than 50%.
What we lawyers say is a preponderance of the evidence, that to most people means just a little more than half. So more likely than not, it might be 50% plus one.
Exactly.
Tip the scales.
But and Eric's example was a good one. The failure to diagnose cancer is a kind of a classic situation. We get a lot of calls like that because once many people that end up with cancer have been to the doctor, and may not have been diagnosed, and that may be perfectly reasonable because their symptoms may not have related to the cancer it turned out they had, or it may be they were and the doctors, you know, did make a mistake. But the fact is that the cancer they had already made them have a very poor prognosis and an unlikely chance of living long before they had the symptoms. Metastasis can occur very early. And that's an example of you have to prove that the conduct of the doctor would have made a difference. You
know, one other thing, too, is that people call in and may have a question about a case. And again, it could be a clear malpractice situation, but it could be capped at $250,000. In other words, the micro laws that we referred to earlier that have been in effect since 1975 would cap the value of the case at $250,000 if there was no future economic damages, no future medical expenses or wage loss. So, for instance, if there's a let's say that there's a baby who's born stillbirth and it's a consequence of malpractice, that case would be $250,000. A wrongful death of a child, $250,000. Wrongful death of, you know, an adult who's not supporting anyone or not married, $250,000. So those are cases, even though there could be oh my God, quality of malpractice, where we would be unable to take the case because these cases cost so much to prosecute. Economically, we have to explain that to the clients. It's just it's a process. Like these cases, Jim knows better than I. But you know, we can spend on some of these cases. We work up hundreds of thousands of dollars to work up a case.
That's something I think that is worthy of discussion, and that is. Because somebody out there listening would say, well, wait a minute, $250,000 and you get your fee based on that, and why wouldn't that be something you could take? I have had the so often I hate to think about how often I've had to explain to a family that has lost their child, a 10-year-old child, maybe their only child, that I can't take their case. And it's a terrible thing to have to talk about. But the fact is that I practice in Hawaii also, and I can take that case in Hawaii. And that case is worth, you know, millions of dollars potentially in Hawaii. But I can take it there. Here, why can't I take it? That's what Eric was starting to talk about. And that's because any malpractice case prepared properly is going to cost a minimum of $50,000-$75,000, maybe a lot more, and if you take that, and you consider that the defense knows that you couldn't possibly get more than $250,000 for it, so they're never going to offer anywhere near that. Say you were offered $150,000 or $200,000, and you had $75,000 or $100,000 into it, you already have almost as much in the way of costs into it. Then the client would get, and your fees on that would actually be less than your cost that you put in. And let's remember, these are high risk. They're medical malpractice cases. No accountant would ever tell you to take that case. Your CPA would say you're crazy.
Are there similar limitations on the expenditures of the attorneys defending these cases?
no limits on them. They can have as much expenditure as they want. They can spend all the costs they want. Insurance companies cover their costs. They get paid whether they win or lose. The lawyer taking the case for the injured party or the deceased party, the families, they only get paid if they win. We only get paid if we win.
And, of course, if they hire experts, you have to hire experts.
Oh, yeah. And if they're expensive.
And if they do investigation, you have to do the investigation.
You have to hire experts in a medical malpractice case to prove the case. So even though Jim's practiced medical malpractice for over 40 years and I'm coming up on 30 years, our opinions don't mean anything in court regarding the standard of care for a physician. We have to have experts come in and testify that the defendants in the case violated the standard of care, and then we have to have experts come in and talk about whether or not that violation caused an injury, and then we have to have experts come in and talk about the injuries.
And, of course, they may do that by spending dozens of hours, hundreds of hours reviewing records, looking through similar results, similar cases, and looking to see if it's really aberrant results, all sorts of time and expense.
Well, that's correct.
Just a life care plan for an injured party can cost $20,000 or $25,000, and that's before the person that has done that life care plan for you has testified. And if they come into court and testify, they're going to take a lot of time preparing, and there's maybe going to be another $10,000, $15,000, $20,000.
And that's a good.
That's one expert.
And that's a good point too. You know, one of the things that the patients or clients, pardon me, when they call in, they ask, you know, what's the objective of litigation? What are we trying to accomplish here? And what we're trying to accomplish is funding a life care plan. And let's say you have a child with a birth injury. To create a life care plan, you have a physiatrist and a nurse and a life care planner go into the home and evaluate the child and determine that child's needs. And the big question in a life care plan is determining what level of attendant care that child's going to require, an LVN, RN, 24/7, that type of thing. And that's very, very expensive. And that gets put into this plan all the way down to modified vans, modified wheelchairs, modified restrooms, things like that, ADA compliant. And that gets reduced to a number by our economist. And that is what we're trying to deliver to the client. So this is what the purpose of litigation is to do for you and how it could change your life with a child with a birth injury or, you know, say an adult with a stroke who's had a stroke and has, you know, in-home care needs. That's what we're trying to deliver. And, of course, if there's wage loss and things like that, that's also part of the equation.
We've talked a little bit about what we seek to get from this litigation. We've talked a little bit about limitations on the types of cases you can take, at least here in California. Talk to me a little bit about the cases you do take routinely. What kinds of injuries do you normally work with?
Well, maybe it would be helpful to make a comparison. For instance, I remember a few years ago, I was in 1 week, I was offered a case for the, you know, two different families. They came in and they were seeking representation, and one of them was for a daughter that was 14 years old, their only daughter, that had been lost, died in an ATV rollover in a Bible camp. Where you'd have to consider filing a lawsuit against a church. And then the other family came in, also had lost a 14-year-old little boy, their only child, but it was for medical malpractice. I couldn't take the medical malpractice case that week, and I ultimately took the other case and ultimately resolved it by settlement for over $5 million. That is just a graphic description of the difference between kinds of cases and what the limits on that affect you in a malpractice case is affected and compared to a non-malpractice case. Or let's say a person has an injury where they lose their leg below the knee. I've had cases where multi-million dollar results in an auto accident or a products case involving the loss of a leg. But in a malpractice case, once the leg is off, there are no future needs. You have to have a prosthetic, and the prosthetic is replaced periodically, and that's it. There's no real long-term, there's no need for an attendant. There's no need for constant medical care. That leg is gone. That person's life is totally different. That person is different. But in a malpractice case, that's probably not a case we could take.
Yeah, so pain and suffering is the emotional damage someone suffers as a consequence of the malpractice. And so we end up looking for damages that are calculable in terms of medical expenses, in terms of wage loss and things of that nature. That is what drives whether or not we can take a case.
And the ones we take are, you know, typically people, for instance, I have several cases recently where people have had a loss of all of their arms and legs, which can typically occur in a case of infection with septic shock. And when you're in septic shock, you have to get certain medications that can cause your blood supply and your extremities to go way down. It saves your life, but it can cause you to lose your arms and legs. And I've had several young clients, as has Eric, that, you know, don't have any legs or hands. And those are cases where they'll have need prosthetic needs and attendant care needs for the rest of their lives. And same with a brain injury or paralysis. The book's about a young man who is paralyzed from the neck down, and he cannot do his own transfers. He has to have someone physically present 24 hours a day because he can't get out of bed, he can't get out of a chair, he can't do anything without somebody helping him. And that's the situation with a quadriplegic who has got a perfectly normal cognitive ability, but they are unable to function below their neck, or a brain-injured person that needs care 24/7. That's the kind of cases that we do, or the death of a father who has four kids and supports the family and now is gone.
In a moment, I'm going to want to shift gears a little bit and talk about people's experience, what someone really can expect when they're making a claim. Obviously, we don't necessarily want to focus on the injury, but really more process. I'd like to kind of walk through the nuts and bolts. They come into your office, what you're doing, what they're doing, and kind of build up an expectation of what people would experience. You're listening to Your Legal Rights on KALW-FM 91.7 in San Francisco. I'm Jeff Hayden, and tonight we're talking to attorneys who represent victims of personal injury, general negligence, and especially medical malpractice. Mill Valley attorneys James Bostwick and Eric Peterson. If you have questions for my guests, our phone number to us here in the studio is 415-841-4134. Again, that's 415-841-4134. If you're outside of the local dialing area, call us toll-free at 866-798-8255. That's 866-798-8255. And as always, you can call regarding any question on the topic. You're not limited to where we may be in our conversation. If you want to talk about injury, you want to talk about negligence, you want to talk about writing a book, feel free to call us. And again, if you're outside of San Francisco, our toll-free number is 866-798-8255. You're listening to Your Legal Rights. We'll be back right after this.
Hi, I'm John Carroll, Director of Development here at KALW. We're glad to be a part of your daily life and hope you love our locally produced music and news shows, but we get it. You're busy. Maybe you've thought about becoming a member and haven't gotten around to it. Or perhaps you were a KALW member in the past and still listens every day. Or maybe you're new to the Bay Area. Whatever the reason, don't wait. Go online to KALW.org and consider becoming a member today. We'll be glad to do it. Thanks.
You're listening to 91.7 KALW San Francisco Local Public Radio. Support for KALW is provided by the Bar Association of San Francisco. If you live in San Francisco or Marin County, the Bar's Association's Lawyers Referral Service can arrange for you to meet with an attorney experienced in the area of law related to your situation. For more information, you can call 415-989 1616 or visit sfbar.org for more information.
So as I mentioned right before our break, I wanted to shift gears a little bit, talk about someone's experience when they go to make such a claim, starting from the process when they walk through your door. And if you wanted to use the story in the book to illustrate from time to time, feel free to break into the book as well. But I'm walking in your door. I want to tell you about my experience. What's the first thing I'm going to notice?
What are you going to notice? You're going to notice us sitting down and asking you a lot of questions. We are definitely going to go through a long list of questions to try to find out everything that you know about what happened to you. We have to have a list of the all your providers, if it's a medical malpractice case. If it's not a medical malpractice case, the same thing. We have to know all of your history, everything from the past. We want to know everything there is about you and your family, your injury, if there's an injury, or the person that you're coming to talk to us about. And we gather all that information to start with. And that just initiates the process. And then, of course, we would talk to you about how you hire a lawyer. I mean, when you hire a lawyer, you're going to have to assign a contract, and that actually officially hires the lawyer to represent you. And you have to talk about what the fees are and how the fees work, how contingent fees work. And they are different for different kinds of cases. They're actually limited in malpractice cases. We talk about all that. And we generally develop all that information, and then we do exactly what you just did, because then the client says, well, what can I expect? What is the lawsuit going to be like? And then at that point, we sit down and we're, we explain to them what the process will be right from that point on. Well, Eric, why don't you tell?
Yeah, often our prospective clients communicate with us for the first time through our website.
Yeah.
And they may chat with us. They may call an intake paralegal, or they may call and talk with us directly. And oftentimes our clients aren't just in San Francisco. They're, all over the state of California and Hawaii. So we'll go ahead and we'll get an authorization for the release of medical records sent to the prospective client, and we'll order the medical records, again, assuming it's a medical malpractice case, from all the healthcare providers. And that process could take 2 or 3 weeks to get the records back in. And then we will either, when Jim has a case, Jim will look at the records. I'll have a case. I'll look at the records. And we look at something called the statute of limitations pretty closely at this point. We're trying to determine whether or not the claim is time barred. In the state of California, you have to bring the medical malpractice case within the statute of limitations. Otherwise, you're going to be precluded from doing it at any point down the road. So you get the records in, you review the records, and then you have them reviewed by medical experts. And if the medical experts you've had take a look at the case say, you do have something here in terms of standard care violation that caused injury, then we'll go ahead and we'll file the lawsuit. And the lawsuit will be filed in the county in which the malpractice occurred. And it's a complaint, which is just a document that's very basic. It's notice pleading that's filed in the courthouse that says we're suing these doctors and we represent these people. And that complaint is ultimately served on the healthcare providers, and that starts the litigation process. And so far in all this, the client has not really done anything except give us the medical records, authorization for the records, and we've talked to them and explained the process. And then we begin the discovery process.
Talk to me a little bit about discovery. I have a sense of discovery from criminal litigation, but it's quite different, isn't it?
Yes, very, very different. In criminal litigation, not that I'm an expert in it, but you're required, the prosecutor is required to give some information to the defending lawyer. But basically, it's the problem in that area is that you don't get to actually go out and start taking people's testimony in advance so you can make decisions about the case. That doesn't happen in criminal law.
Let me back up just a little bit and explain to our listeners that discovery is the process by which we obtain information And it may be from asking questions to the other side or telling them what documents they need to deliver and the like. Or it may be going out to third parties and saying, you've got something we want. Send us a copy. We want it in our office.
Right. There's number one, you would say to the all of the healthcare providers, we want copies of all the records of our client. And the defense would do the same thing. And that's a form of discovery. You're discovering what the medical records are. And then also you're going to send questions to the defense. Tell us about, you know, your history, your professional background, if it's a medical case. Tell us about all, you know, what happened in the accident, if it's an accident. There are all kinds of questions that can be either questions that are form questions that are used or questions you can make up specially to fit a particular situation. Then after you've done all that and gotten all these answers, then you have to take actual testimony. And we will – all the important parties involved will all be deposed. Deposed means we're going to sit down with a court reporter and under oath, just like you're in court, get the testimony, cross-examine the person, find out everything you can possibly find out about what happened, what their thinking was, what went wrong, and things like that. In a medical deposition can take anywhere from 2 to 3 to 7 hours.
And the plaintiff, the person bringing the lawsuit, the person who hires us, will also be deposed, typically in a case. And we spend quite a bit of time preparing them for the deposition process and what to expect. It's unlike what you see on TV. Mm-hmm. It's a very civil process by and large. And, clients are rightfully a little bit nervous. Most of them have never been deposed before. But it's really an opportunity for the defense to see the plaintiff and to learn about the plaintiff and to see how appealing they may be in front of a jury, and an opportunity for the plaintiff to kind of help kind of promote the case to the defense. Because the defense goes back and reports, does this person appear to be credible? Are they likable? Is a jury going to be attracted to them and to their story? And so it's the deposition is also something that occurs for the plaintiffs as well.
Yeah, when you're litigating a case, the defense decision makers ultimately usually are the insurance company. And the insurance company is not going to get to usually meet your client. They're not going to be there at the deposition. And so what the lawyer is doing, the defense lawyer, is they're finding out what is your client like. What kind of person they are? What is the jury going to think of them? And that's what this deposition process teaches them. So we spend a lot of time with the clients ahead of time preparing them for that process, getting them used to it, asking them questions ourselves, and educating them about what is the defense really interested in here. They want to learn about you. They want to get to know who you are and what your family is, what your background, and they want to learn about your injury and the situation, and they want to get to know what kind of a witness you'll make in court, and we want to help you be good at that.
The discovery process is an act where everyone has to put their cards on the table, and the whole system is designed to promote a free flow exchange of information so that people aren't going to trial and having a Perry Mason moment, the aha moment, where they think, oh, my gosh, had I known this, we could have settled the case 6 months earlier. So it's designed to try and create a situation where everyone knows the good, the bad, the ugly of their case and the other case and can promote the opportunity to try and resolve a case short of litigation. They're trying to get cases to resolve before you go to court.
And the reality is there's only so many courtrooms. It doesn't matter if it's public or private.
Yep.
The fact is there's only so many resources. And as I tell people from my own practice, if both sides can know in advance what's going to be the outcome, then very few of the cases go to trial. Mm-hmm. Sometimes there's variables we can't account for, or there's various reasons that people want to have their day. And they're entitled to, and they should be entitled to. But most of the time, if both sides can predict the outcome, reasonable minds can get together and figure out a way to resolve it.
Well, and nowadays, the courts really want every case to have had a reasonable chance of being resolved outside of the courtroom. Because in the courtroom, it's just like a football game, and like we're going to see at the Super Bowl, one's going to win and one's going to lose. And usually that's what ends up happening in court. There are, you know, variations on that theme. But bottom line is somebody's going to be very unhappy and disappointed. And if you can resolve the case, if you can reach a reasonable settlement, and some, you know, one judge once said to me, the, you know, the definition of a good settlement is where everyone goes away unhappy, because it's a compromise. But it is something that then is a sure thing for both sides. So the judges like all cases to have gone through that process. So that's another thing that the clients will somewhere along the line be faced with, and that is there a chance to settle this case, and what can we get for it, and what should we do? And most clients will say to their lawyer, well, how much is the case worth? And they will say to the lawyer, you know, how much can we get? And they'll say to the lawyer, well, they've offered this amount of money. Should I take it or not? And that is a very difficult and complicated question, because the bottom line is no lawyer can tell a client honestly that they know what is going to happen in a courtroom. The fact is that you can be totally prepared. You can do everything you need to do and get in the courtroom, and things can change because the witnesses are human. The jurors are human. The judge is human. We can't predict everything. And the bottom line is that the best case can be lost and the worst case can be won. I mean, and everywhere in between. So the lawyer has to just try to do the best they can to make a recommendation within certain bounds, making sure that the client very carefully understands the risks, because there are always risks. And that's true of both sides. The defense has to do the same thing. The defense is talking to the defendant that they're representing, who may have an insurance policy, and the plaintiff may be seeking more than what their insurance coverage is. They also have to talk to the insurance company. Can they save money on this case or not? What is going to be the risk? And those are the kind of choices that end up coming down to.
And when you say understanding the risk, that doesn't necessarily mean you're overwhelmed with the risk. It means that you can properly assess the risks and benefits and weigh what's your best strategy. And sometimes that means don't overestimate the risk you're facing. Understand it so you know it's safe to go forward, and know that you'd be better off with this settlement that's been offered.
Yes. That's right. And oftentimes what happens is that you assess the risk in a mediation process. So getting back to your process, once you file the complaint and the discovery is more or less complete and everyone knows where everyone stands, good cases tend to go to mediation. And that's where both parties will voluntarily select a mediator, who's a private mediator, and they pay that person to try and broker a settlement between the parties. And most cases end up going to mediation, and a lot of cases settle in the mediation process.
Now, early on, after I started hosting this show, we did a show on mediation. We probably are past due to do one again. What's interesting to me is it's not necessarily splitting it down the middle.
Nope.
Or finding what each person is motivated by, but it goes a little further than that, and finding really what risks there are on each side and really making sure that everybody assesses it correctly, and finding a way to make everybody unhappy.
Mm-hmm. Yes, it's really more, I mean, you never get everything you want if you're a plaintiff, and you never, you know, get away without spending, the amount of money that you would prefer not to spend if you're the defense. It's something that has to come together. And if everybody walks away unhappy, that's probably the definition of a good settlement.
And speaking of settlements, Jim, I understand that you once held the record for the largest settlement in medical malpractice case in this state. Tell us a little bit about the case itself.
Well, I had the largest jury verdict, if that's what you're talking about, the largest jury verdict in the country at one point. Those things tend to change. But at the time, back in the 70s, it was on Walter Cronkite. It was in, you know, all over the world. I got newspapers sent to me from Germany and China. It was pretty amazing. And that, you know, that was a record for quite a period of time. And then back, and there have been several other records along the way, but back in 2014, I did get a settlement that we believe is the largest settlement malpractice case, the largest malpractice settlement in the state history. Unfortunately, my partner here blew that away last year.
So you held the largest settlement in a malpractice case
in 2018, yeah.
And that record's already been broken.
Yeah, by my partner over here, yes.
And Eric, you eclipsed that record.
I did, yeah.
Tell us a little bit about that case. I'm not looking for dollars and cents and not looking, obviously, to identify parties. But what was the case about?
Well, you know, typically cases that you know, have this kind of high value involve children with brain injuries. And so without getting into a lot of the details of this particular case, this involved a child who had a brain injury due to malpractice. And the question became, what's it going to take care of this child for the rest of this child's life? And so the life care plan in this case involved, you know, 24/7 LVN level care, which is very, very expensive, for a long period of time. It included her wage loss and included modifications to her home. And so those cases, the cases that Jim has that are very high value, the one he had just before this involved the same type of incident, where you have someone who's got a lot of economic damage.
And you're wondering, why aren't we giving you more detail? Because, and the reason is because one of the things the defense insists on nowadays is that if they're going to pay you a settlement, they don't want any publicity about it. So they don't want to have their name come out. They don't want to have the details of the case come out. They don't want to know who the defendants were. And so that's why we're just talking about the general nature of the injury.
So telling us it happened in Monterey County or San Luis Obispo or something like that really goes too far towards identifying the party, because then people can start digging for it. So
right,
we keep it pretty vague.
In medical malpractice cases, anytime you're talking about a record verdict, you're probably talking about a birth injured child. Wouldn't you agree, Jim?
Usually it's a birth injury. Usually it's some kind of a brain damage or paralysis or a combination thereof, typically, because those are the cases that are going to have the largest, quote, life care plans, unquote. And in other words, it's going to take the most amount of resources to take care of the people. And those people are young, and they're going to have a long life if they're healthy. Now, of course, that's one of the issues that in the case. The defense is always going to contend that they're going to die early. So that's another thing that has to be litigated with a myriad of experts.
Tell us more about some of the other kinds of cases that that you guys handle.
Well, I had a case not too long ago. Actually, Eric helped me try this, where a woman was in a car, and she was hit rear-ender by a truck, and it was right over near the ballpark, and she was hit. She was taken to the hospital. She didn't lose consciousness, but she actually ended up with a bleed in her brain, and she had ultimately was what we call a mild traumatic brain injury. Now she didn't have any physical problems, and she was fine, except that she had trouble with what we call executive function. And so, in other words, she had an IQ of about 150. I think she was certainly smarter than either Eric or myself. And put together, and smarter than the Harvard trained judge, who was a marvelous judge. But she could not do more than one thing at a time, and so we tried that case against a very substantial offer, as I recall, about $6 million offer, and which is a lot of money to see what a jury will do with, and that was a record verdict at the time was $20 million. And the challenge in the case really was interesting. The challenge in the case was to help a jury understand that you could look perfectly fine, you could answer questions in court, but you could have serious cognitive impairment that was profoundly affecting your ability to, you know, interact with your family, interact with and do work and have a reasonable life. And the jury understood that at the end of the case.
Yeah, so we will routinely look at personal injury cases that involve catastrophic injuries like automobile accidents. We've also handled legal malpractice cases and have done some Jones Act cases, which are maritime cases involving seamen who are injured on a vessel in navigation, and we've handled those cases as well.
You mentioned legal malpractice. Tell us a little bit about those.
That's actually what that book is about, because the kid was in an accident, but the lawyer that was handling the case, the famous lawyer, didn't figure out that he was able to move his arms and legs when he got to the hospital, and he lost his ability to move his arms and legs while in the hospital. He missed that. He and his firm missed that.
When you say he missed that, he missed the connection between the hospital?
He missed the fact that the damage to the spinal cord of the young man actually occurred during the course of the medical treatment. He did not need to be paralyzed. He wasn't paralyzed when he got there.
So ultimately, instead of focusing on the accident that sent him to the hospital, he should have been focusing on the hospital that perhaps didn't provide the standard of care that they should have.
Well, that's the interesting question, is because he, of course, was hired to handle an auto case, but there was very inadequate coverage for a paralyzed young man who would need 24-hour care his whole life. And he got him, you know, a portion of the insurance coverage, which was woefully inadequate to care for the child, but he didn't bother to look further. He got what we would call the easy money. And sent him off on his way, not realizing that he could have filed a case against the medical defendants. But unfortunately, in the book, the statute of limitations had run on the medical defendants. So the protagonist in the book, the young lawyer, David, took on the Goliath, which was the famous lawyer who hadn't let the statute run.
Fascinating how much you can do when you scratch the surface and stop.
Yes.
You're listening to Your Legal Rights on KALW 91.7 FM in San Francisco. There's still but a few minutes if you'd like to call and talk to attorneys who represent victims of personal injury, general negligence, malpractice. Those are attorneys Jim Bostwick and Eric Peterson of Mill Valley. Questions from my guests. You still have a few minutes. Our phone number in the studio is 415-841-4134. Again, 415-841-4134. If you're not in San Francisco, 866-798-8255. That's 866-798-8255. You're not limited to the point we are in our conversation. Any question about negligence, malpractice, personal injury?
I might just say that one of the things we've talked about but haven't really kind of delved into that I think is important for folks out there to understand is that $250,000 limit that is in there, that has been in there since 1975.
And that $250,000 was an awful lot of money in 1975.
And even then, it was considered a ridiculously low amount. And that has never changed with inflation. That amount, just with inflation, would be about $1.5 million nowadays. If it had just changed with a change in the value of money, but it's never changed. And we have a Democratic legislature, and we have a Democratic governor, signed in by a Democratic governor. Governor Brown, because there was a, quote, medical malpractice crisis that was actually just an insurance crisis because they had lost money in the markets.
Yeah, we had an initiative in the last several years to raise the 250 cap up to, what was it, Jim, 750?
Yeah, it was just a modest amount.
Yeah. And it only got 38% of the vote.
Yeah, because the doctors and the insurance companies said that would be a horrible thing.
If you could read this screen that I'm looking at, it's rather scary how you jumped ahead. Maybe you're seeing the reflection of my glasses. This is actually the last point I wanted to talk about was about the malpractice limits under medical malpractice for non-economic damages. And as you mentioned before, other forms of negligence don't have those limits?
Absolutely not.
That's right.
The woman who was hit by the truck in her car had absolutely no limits, and her life was changed, and the jury could decide what they thought was a reasonable for the change of her life. Now, she also had a very large wage loss because she was a very high earning person, but the change in her life was dramatic, and the jury understood that and gave her actually 10 times what the limit is. They gave her $2.5 million.
Do most other states have similar limits on medical injury?
Some do, some don't. I practice in Colorado. It does. I practice in Hawaii. It does not. It has one for just pain and suffering, but not for changing the quality of your life, not for humiliation, not for anything else. And so, in fact, you know, there's no real limit in Hawaii. And the extraordinary change, because people call us and they say, but my whole life has changed. I can't do any of the things I used to do. But if there's no economic loss, it's still only $250. And they can spend hours telling us about how their life has been destroyed, and that still doesn't go over $250. Unless there's economics.
Well, we reached the end of our hour. I'd like to give you each a minute or so. Unfortunately, not much more, but I'd like to give you each a minute if there's any closing thoughts you have or anything you wanted to say to sum up. Eric, would you like to go first?
Well, you know, I would just say that anyone who thought that they may have a medical malpractice case or a personal injury case, it's really easy to reach out and to connect with an attorney online and to simply ask, do you think I've got a case? And, you know, we can look at cases, and other law firms can look at cases and evaluate them very, very quickly. But you want to do it before the statute of limitations, you know, runs on your case, because at that point you'll be out of options. So it never hurts to ask. I think some people are intimidated. They think we're going to call a lawyer and I don't want to bother them. But you just have to ask, and we can get back to you very, very quickly with our thoughts about whether I've got a case.
And people should not be thinking about calling you before the statute runs out. People should be thinking about calling you as quickly as possible so that you can do what you have to do to analyze the case before the statute runs.
Don't wait till the 11th hour.
Somebody come to me the day before the statute ran out, two people, and filed a case really in the dark, because if I didn't file that case, it would have been forever lost.
Right. That's exactly right.
It should have been forever lost. But that's that case. Jim, any closing thoughts?
Just backing away from all this, I'd like to say that what really motivates Eric and myself and our colleagues that we know that are that we've known for many years that do this practice, they're lawyers all over the country who do this kind of work, and what really motivates us is because we can actually help people. If you're badly injured, we might be able to make a difference in your life, and that's a very good feeling for us.
You've been listening to Your Legal Rights on KALW 91.7 FM in San Francisco. I'm Jeff Hayden. Tonight we're talking to attorneys who represent people suffering injuries due to negligence and professional liability. With me in the studio tonight, my guests, James Bostwick and Eric Peterson, both practicing out of Mill Valley, both representing plaintiffs in catastrophic injury, general negligence, malpractice in this state and others. And I'd like to thank both of you for joining us. Again, you're listening to Your Legal Rights on KALW 91.7 FM in San Francisco or KALW.org. For production assistant Martin McLean, and joining us at the controls tonight, D Minor. I'm Jeff Hayden. We return next week with Your Legal Rights, and next week is a Call a Lawyer night. Our thanks to you for listening, and have a good night.
You're listening to 91.7 KALW San Francisco Local Public Radio. Time now is 7:59, and support for KALW is provided by the Bar Association of San Francisco. If you live in San Francisco or in the surrounding areas, like in the Marin County area, the Bar Association's Lawyer Referral Service can arrange for you to meet with an attorney experienced in the area of law related to your situation. You can call 415-989-1616 or visit sfbar.org for more details.